Okay, so Anatolis Petkovsky is my PhD thesis advisor at Princeton. Benoit and Sasha were former postdocs, also contributing to this research. I'll go straight into the topic. So what is a pulsar? The pulsar is a rapidly spinning neutron star, the central object sitting here. So it's a 10-kilometer neutron star spinning rapidly with periods starting from 1 second and low. The most fast spinning pulsar discovered was with a period about a few milliseconds. And on top of that, it has a very high magnetic field. So it's a 10-kilometer object spinning at a few milliseconds with 10 to 12 Gauss magnetic field. So what happens when you have magnetic field and orbit the central star, you induce electric fields, the phenomena called unipolar induction. Just because you wind up magnetic field, you produce electric field. And this is the simplest experiment. You put a conducting disk in magnetic field, you start to rotate, and you measure some voltage across it. So the voltage, the electric field is of order of rotational velocity of the star divided by the speed of light times the magnetic field. This is a characteristic voltage that you find in this problem. Part of this electric field is pointing along the magnetic field in vacuum. So you have a neutron star surface which has upper layers which are composed of a typical matter. So you have electrons and protons, and you have electric field which highly exceeds the binding energy of these electrons and protons to the surface. So this electric field extracts charges from the neutron star atmosphere, and there start to populate the surroundings of the pulsar, which we call magnetosphere. So the magnetosphere is the surrounding of the neutron star. So it's not entirely vacuum. You start to get charges from the neutron star surface, and then these charges, they are accelerated to high energies in this electric field, and then they travel along curved magnetic field lines. So to first order, you can count this magnetic field as a dipolar structure. They have some curvature, and when a charge moves along a curved field line, it experiences an acceleration. So the trajectory is bended, so the particle is accelerated towards the local central of curvature of the magnetic field line, and because of that, it emits radiation. This radiation we call curvature radiation. It's just like a radiation of a particle which travels along a curved field line. This curvature radiation is something around GeV energy, so you have GeV photons in 10 to 12 Gauss magnetic field. These photons are absorbed by magnetic field, so you get, instead of gamma quanta and magnetic field, you get a pair. So these pairs are picked by this high electric field, they're accelerated again. They again emit this curvature photons, and also they emit synchrotron radiation because these pairs are produced at non-zero Landau level, and because the magnetic field is so high, they quickly release this transverse energy to the field line, and this is emitted as synchrotron radiation. So you have lots of photons. They are around GeV energy, so they can be converted by magnetic field into pairs. So just from one particle which you extracted from the surface, you end up with many particles. So the idea is that these two mechanisms populate the surroundings of the neutron star with electron and positron pairs, and these pairs also drive charge densities and current densities, and these charges and currents provide the feedback on initial dipolar magnetic field structure, and the fields change, the currents are formed, and you need to understand how this looks like. Observationally, just from astrophysical point of view, the sources are seen in many bands of electromagnetic radiation. So they were originally discovered in radio waves, but after that they were just like this most famous Crab pulsar was discovered in optical X-rays, and most recently what was fascinating was launch of the Fermi satellite, which discovered around 100 of pulsars in gamma rays. So they're seen across electromagnetic spectrum. And the morphology is very complicated. Sometimes you see radio waves coming in phase with optical X-ray and gamma rays, as in the Crab example. Sometimes they're very much out of phase, so you need to explain all of this morphology. So the open questions about this cartoon picture is how this structure actually works. So I described that there are particles, there are pairs, they drive currents, but what's the result of that is uncertain. What we do know is that this pulsar wind, so the wind of electromagnetic fields and particles which propagates into the surroundings, forms what we call pulsar wind nebulae. And this nebula is seen also in X-rays. If you try to reconstruct the luminosity in the X-rays into the number of particles that are emitting this radiation, you get that though the plasma in this magnetosphere is collisionless, so the mean free path to Coulomb collisions is way larger than characteristic scales of the magnetosphere. Besides that, the plasma is what we call dense plasma. So by dense, I mean that this plasma is enough to actually screen the electric fields that you develop in the first place. So I'll come to this question later. So to get this powerful emission, you need to get some sort of particle acceleration. So to emit powerful gamma rays, particles should be accelerated. How and where this happens is a topic of recent research. And how these particles produce radiation is also a question. So the first papers which describe the cartoon picture of how this looked like goes into 69 by Peter Goldreich, who thought only about of charges extracted from the surface. So his idea was that the binding energy should be small. You extract enough charges from the neutron star upper layers. These charges are enough to screen the vacuum electric field which you develop from rotation of the central star. And the characteristic density of charges which is needed to do that is now called the Goldreich and Julian charge density. This is just a divergence of a vacuum electric field which you develop by spinning the central conductor in the magnetic field. So the characteristic charge density is just omega, the rotation rate of the star times magnetic field. And these charges which you extract along this region, which we call polar cap, drive a current along the magnetic field lines. This current of charged particles produce a toroidal field, which is shown as this directions out of plane. So there is a B phi, and which is produced by the what we call poloidal current, so a current along the field line. And then there is electric field, which is E theta in this case. So the electric field just from rotation of the field lines. So you get E theta and B phi. The cross product of them is a Poynting flux. It's directed outwards. So this flux of electromagnetic fields and particles produces a Poynting flux which goes outwards. And these currents are closed at the stellar surface. And when the currents are closed, they go across magnetic field lines. So the current is going along theta here, and the magnetic field is directed mostly along radial. So there is an Ampere force torque on the central star, which goes into reducing the rotation speed of the star. So the energy budget here comes from the rotation of the central star. It loses its rotational energy. The outcome goes as particles, as fields in the form of the Poynting flux, and the rotation rate is rotation rate decreases smoothly with time, and this is observed when you time the radio pulses from pulsars. So this is the cartoon picture from 69, and it took 35 years to actually to provide some sort of a quantitative paradigm for this picture. And this is what we call force-free electromagnetic paradigm. So this is a limit of a relativistic magnetohydrodynamics, in the limit where inertia of plasma particles and pressure are not important. So this is your usual momentum equation, Lorentz force equals to inertia term plus gradient of pressure. And since electromagnetic fields are so high, you can neglect the two, and you left up with Lorentz force equals to zero. So the simplest momentum equation you can imagine. From this, you can find what your current density is. Your current density is charge density times E cross B drift divided by B squared. This is the first term. This is just the charge density from the first Maxwell's equations. And then you have a current along the magnetic field, which is not specified by this equation. And this you can find by assuming that the plasma, though its density, energy density is much less than the energy density of the magnetic field, it's still dense enough to screen the electric field. So the electric field along magnetic field is always zero. So this is the usual assumption of plasma physics. When you add up enough charges, they create plasma oscillations. And these plasma oscillations screen the background electric field. So the plasma, the charge neutral plasma doesn't like a huge electric field. So from these two conditions, you can find...
So what parameters that allow you to implement this condition, like in terms of the particle density, in terms of the magnetic field, or the, like, what has to be large compared to
This is a number, the minimal number density that is needed to screen the electric field. If you're much larger than that, you're fine. This assumption is then justified. So the number density should be much larger than this quantity. And from this pair cascade physics that I described to you, it's thought that the multiplicity, which the multiplicity is the ratio of the actual plasma density divided by this one, is around 10 to 5. So the large parameter in this problem is around 10 to 5. So there are 10 to 5 charges which are fine to screen this electric field. And the second parameter which justifies this equation is what we call sigma parameter, the energy density of the magnetic field divided by the plasma energy density. This is also like close to the star, it's enormous. At the light cylinder, at the like characteristic distance in the magnetosphere, it's around 10 to 5 or 10 to 4. So there are still two large numbers. So these two parameters justify using of these two equations. And after that, you're left with a current density, which is only a function of electric and magnetic field. And when you plug this back into Maxwell's equations, you have a time evolution system for electric and magnetic field. And on the right-hand side, you only have spatial derivatives or like multiplication of magnetic fields and electric fields. So this you can solve from the computer, which was done around 2000s by several people. And the simplest problem which you can imagine, where the magnetic axis of the central star is aligned with the rotational axis of the pulsar, this is what you get. So initially you had the dipolar magnetic field lines, and they still remain in the closed region near the star, which we call the inner magnetosphere. This surface, which we call a light cylinder, is a surface where the rotational velocity, which is just omega times r, equals to the speed of light. So if you want to co-rotate with the central star, at this cylindrical distance from the star, you'll have to co-rotate with the speed of light. This is a characteristic length scale in the problem. So you have light cylinder, you have your central object, initially dipolar magnetic field lines in the inner zone. At outer zone, they stretched out. This is because this charge density that I described to you in the inner magnetosphere, it co-rotates with the star. So you have toroidal currents sitting around here. Toroidal currents change the magnetic field lines in this plane. We call this a poloidal plane. So everything besides toroidal is called poloidal, apparently. So you have toroidal currents, and they stretched out this field line. So they start as dipolar and end up something like a monopolar wind at huge densities, at huge radii. So initially, dipolar field lines turned out to be monopolar field lines at larger distances. And this color here shows the toroidal field, and red and green are toroidal fields of opposite direction. They meet each other at the equatorial plane, and when you have a sudden jump of the magnetic field, you have to get a current flying out there. So just from this equation, in the steady state, this is zero. If you have a jump of B, you have large curl, you need sufficient current to justify that. This region is what we call current sheet. So this is how the current is closed in the problem. You have your current flying out from this region around the magnetic axis, which we call polar cap. So current flies out from the polar cap, and this is closed up along the boundary of the closed magnetic field lined region and the equatorial current sheet. So huge currents fly along this this circuit. So this was a nice step forward, and then it was realized that you can do this in full 3D with magnetic axis, which is not necessarily aligned with the rotational axis, and this is how actual pulsars look like. So this is a three-dimensional solution obtained by Anatoly Spitkovsky in 2006, like later confirmed by other people. So you still see certain features of an axisymmetric structure. You still see field lines in the inner magnetosphere which look like an initial dipolar field. you then see field lines stretching out at infinity, looking like a monopole. But the surface at which your field direction and magnitude changes is now a time-dependent structure. So this current sheet, which was initially just an equatorial slice, is now a complicated three-dimensional structure which oscillates around with time. So what was actually interesting that you can compute the electromagnetic luminosity, so the amount of power that goes in electromagnetic energy outwards from the pulsar, you can compute it as a function of the inclination angle. It was found that it actually increases with inclination. So this was a nice step forward in quantifying the picture about pulsar magnetospheres. Unfortunately, though you can provide the solution in certain limit, when the sigma and the multiplicity parameters are large, you cannot study several important things. So first, you cannot you don't know how the magnetospheric plasma is actually produced. So you rely on the assumption that plasma is dense everywhere, and no matter how it is produced. So this doesn't necessarily to be the case. Also, you cannot say that the solution is unique. So you've started from a certain state, assume that this magnetospheric plasma is abundant everywhere, and found one solution. So what about other solutions? Like if plasma is not abundant everywhere, or it's not produced at all, so how would the picture look like? This is since we forgot everything about plasma physics in the previous picture, we don't know how particles are accelerated. We assume that electric field is perpendicular to the magnetic field everywhere. So we could not study particle acceleration. And also we could not study non-thermal emission, but this is because we didn't know how particles are accelerated. So this is the table which just shows you what was done with MHD. You take into account charge densities, currents. With the full MHD, you can take into account the density of plasma and temperature effects, but nothing about non-thermal particle distribution or plasma instabilities, which are thought to be responsible for coherent radio emission from these neutron stars. So to do full plasma physics completely on the computer, the most developed method so far is what we call a particle-in-cell method. So this is the most fundamental approach to kinetic plasma physics if you want to model this on the computer. And the equations we are solving are the Maxwell's equations plus equations of particle motion, which is just dp dt equals to Lorentz force. The computational loop looks like this. You start from initial particle distribution and some initial distribution of electromagnetic fields. Then you have a force which acts on this particle. From the force, you can solve this equation and find the new coordinates of the particle. From particle distribution and their charges and their momenta, you can find charge densities and currents. When you know charge densities and currents, you can plug them back into Maxwell's equations and solve for new electric and magnetic fields from Maxwell's equations. You have your new force on each particle. And this is a loop which continues through the calculation. So though it sounds very simple, there are many complications. For example, you need to resolve all timescales in the problem, the shortest timescale being the plasma oscillations timescale, the thing I will describe on the next slide. And there are also timescales, the gyro radius sure?
Oh, okay.
No, ask a question.
With these new simulations you're talking about, are you getting away from the assumption that E dot B equals zero, so you're not assuming perfect screening anymore, or are you still assuming that?
If you have abundant plasma, you get E dot B equals to zero. But from the first principle, if you don't assume that and just see how the magnetosphere develops, you would of course find regions where this is not true. So when it's true, this paradigm reduces to MHD. But when you don't have abundant plasma situation, you provide the full physics.
Radiation of auxiliary charges, then you got your... You're
ignoring. Nice slide. So, relativistic particles say, sure.
So, this previous slide, so all of it was collisionless, right?
Yes, this is collisionless.
There's no notion of like local thermal equilibrium.
Yes. So, you in collisionless plasma, you easily develop non-thermal tails when particles are accelerated, and this is the most essential part of this method. Again, the collision mean free path of these charges is way large, much larger than the light surrender. So it's a collisionless plasma to a very nice degree. So going back to Lewis's question, so you know that relativistic particles emit high-frequency radiation. And if you want to model that self-consistently from Maxwell's equations, you need to resolve this very high frequency, so a very short time scale of phenomena. So this we actually are not doing. If you have a relativistic particle, you actually know how much power does it radiate just from textbook Landau-Lifshitz formula. So just based on its Lorentz factor and electromagnetic fields, you can calculate how much power does the particle radiate. So those high frequency phenomena, these fields are not sitting on your computational grid. You just assume how much power, you actually don't assume, this is like a rigorous result, how much power does each particle emit. And from that, you apply a radiative cooling force on each particle. So besides the Lorentz force, you need to take into account this radiative cooling force. This is the first step that you need to do to simulate magnetospheres beyond the usual particles in Celle method. You need to include this radiative cooling force. So next step that you need to do, you need to take into account that there are conducting spheres. You need conducting boundary conditions on the surface of the star. You need to model these atmospheres of particles, which are these upper layers of plasma that is allowed to be extracted by electric fields. So it's a conducting boundary star with atmosphere of charges on top, which consists of both electrons and ions. And then you need to model this pair creation. So when particles are accelerated, they emit photons, which are actually treated as a separate particle species. So when particle is accelerated, it emits a photon, and this photon is tracked on the grid. So photons are flying at straight lines, and we track their photon collisions or those phenomena which happens in high field. So when a high energy photon travels in the high field, it can be immediately converted into pair. So you model these two phenomena, photon-photon collisions and pair production in strong field, and you find this pair production happening. Also, it turned out that GR is important. I'll tell you this later. So this was improved for simulations in slowly rotating limit of the Kerr metric. And the last thing summarizes just what the scales you can approach with simulation. To be a bit closer to reality, this radius of the star is 10 kilometers. The light cylinder, which I described before, the distance at which you correlate with the speed of light, for real pulsar, it's something like a few thousands of kilometers. So a few thousands of kilometers, 10 kilometers, you get the separation of scales by a few thousands. So this is impossible to do in three dimensions on the computer. You scale things down, but still ensure that this parameter is somewhat large. So in full 3D, we model something like 3 or 5. In axisymmetric simulation, we go up to several tens. So this parameter is still large. You have your plasma physics parameters. So just this is called the electromagnetic skin depth, the ratio of the speed of light and plasma frequency. This is the tiniest scale in the problem. It's like few centimeters on the surface of the star. So a few centimeters versus 10 kilometers is pretty small. We model something like 130, 140 in full 3D. In axisymmetry, we do, again, up to several hundreds or even thousand. So still a large number, and we ensure that physics doesn't change when you scale this to larger things. The last parameter important for particle acceleration is the limit, like what is the maximum energy that you can achieve if accelerating in full electromagnetic field of a vacuum star. So if the star rotates in vacuum, you can calculate what is the maximum potential drop that you can get. And this is a number, the magnetic moment of the star times the rotational rate squared. For real star, like for a Crab pulsar, it's around 10 to 15, so huge number. We model something like a few hundred up to several thousands, still a very large number. And again, physics doesn't qualitatively change when you increase this numbers even more.
How is the initial plasma distributed?
Sorry?
How is the initial plasma distributed?
This slide. So,
yeah, before you go there, one question. So you said you include the effects of TR, but if you plan to compare, say, with your original calculations of anatomy, TR was not there.
Yes, TR was not there.
You need to turn that off and compare.
So it turned out that for large-scale electromagnetic field structure, GR are not important. But for physics of particle acceleration, so for actual electric fields near the star, the GR is important. So if you try to calculate something like a Poynting flux, it's not a huge effect. Because the Poynting flux is set by the large-scale current structure which forms at the light cylinder, which lives in the flat spacetime, actually. And this thing I also will describe when I'll touch on GR next. There was a question of how the plasma is distributed initially. You can do various assumptions, and we tried pretty much all of them. You can assume that you only have particles extracted from the surface without any pair production. Just start in vacuum with this atmosphere. Let electric fields extract the charges and see what will happen. This is original Goldreich and Julian picture, just particles extracted from the surface. Then let's say there is rather particles from the surface. Plus will not care about this pair production physics, something like what is modeled by force free. Force free is assumed that plasma is everywhere. Let's do that. Let's just inject particles around and see what happens. And then we model full pair production physics and the GR effect. And immediately when you do the first step, just particles emitted from the atmosphere, you actually run into trouble. The thing doesn't look like what Goldreich and Julian told you for 40 years. There was a person, Kurt Michael, back in the 80s, who realized that, and he had nice analytical calculations, but no one actually trusted him before early 2000s when it was started to be approached with computers. So what happens here is that when initial electrons are extracted by electric field from the surface, so this is a central star, these are electrons, these are positrons, this initial electrons leave the system and they're left out with the charge sitting on the neutron star. So this charge of the neutron star does the following trick. So when an electron is extracted from the star, at larger distances it starts to feel the field of the central charge and it actually bounces back. So what electrons do in this trapped structure is that they're bouncing back and forth. The electric field close to the star allows them to be extracted, but afterwards they see an opposite sign of electric field and bounce back. So electrons are bouncing back and forth. There is no net current. When you have electrons going that and that way, the net current is zero. And ions or protons are trapped in this equatorial disk around the star, and they don't go anywhere. So if there is no pair production, there is no active plasma solution. All particles are just bouncing around. There is no flux of charges outwards, and no pointing flux, which was introduced in original picture. And even if you do inclined simulation with a pulsar inclined by 30 degrees from the rotational axis, you still find this trapped structure. So no outflow of particles or electromagnetic field. There is a certain caveat in that, which is the instability called the Dijkstra instability. This is an analog of the usual Kelvin-Helmholtz hydro instability in a charge-separated plasma. So imagine electrons, just electrons without ions moving, rotating at different speeds. So this equatorial disk of positively charged particles rotates differentially. And this runs into this Dijkstra instability, which creates a modulation of charges in this disk, which drives modulation of electric fields as well. And some particles, as a result of this instability, tends to escape. So you develop spiral arms of charges actually escaping to infinity. But if you calculate the number of particles that are leaving and the current that they carry, it's actually much smaller than the current which is needed to form the large-scale structure of force-free. So you have few charges living, even in highly nonlinear state of the instability, but the resulting field is still dipolar. So here you see still this disk of charges at the equator, this dome of another sign of charge sitting around. Some particles do escape because of this stuff, but the magnetic field structure is still dipolar, so no outflow of anything. This is the next experiment. So,
sorry, so we have magnetic field is dipolar, but the star is rotating. Aren't the field lines correspond to the velocity of the particles not finding something in the light cylinder?
There is a formal light cylinder, but this structure doesn't extend to this radii.
Oh, okay.
So this, the radius of this equatorial disk and the size of this dome is few stellar radii. And in this experiment, we were actually very careful. If you extend light cylinder even further, this thing doesn't go outside. So this instability doesn't allow for reaching the light cylinder. So particles are going in just magnetic field lines of a dipole. Nothing happens in that. So next experiment, what will happen if you just volumetrically inject particles around? You would think you would reach something like a force free. And indeed, you do reach something like a force free. These are magnetic field lines. They're initially dipolar, but they open up. They form an equatorial current sheet in the midplane. You see different polarities of the field touching together the equatorial plane. This separatrix layer around the last open field line, there is still a current flying around. So something like a force free is formed when you allow for volumetric supply of particles all over the plane. What is new compared to force free simulations, even in this experiment, is that since you have actual particles, you can ask a question, what is the acceleration of particles? And in the next slide, I would show where this happens and to what energies. And you can quantify how much of the pointing flux energy actually goes into that particle. So to accelerate particles, you need to convert some part of the pointing flux which goes outwards into particles. And we found that around 15% of this energy flux is actually converted into energetic particles. So where this happens is, it happens in this equatorial current sheet outside the light cylinder. So the volume rendering here is the mean energy of particles that are accelerated. The blue stuff means the Lorentz factor is around one, so around here. And this red and yellow color means that some sort of particle heating or acceleration happened. So the red and the yellow region highlights the equatorial current sheet beside, beyond the light cylinder. And there the phenomena which we call magnetic reconnection happens. So if you bring two oppositely oriented magnetic field lines together, they touch each other. And when they touch each other, some plasma instabilities happen. You develop electric fields, and those electric fields accelerate particles. So I will go into more details there, but later. But now you, what you need to understand about that is that when you bring these two magnetic field lines together, at the midplane, the magnetic field goes through zero. So the magnetic field energy density is zero at that surface. So all the assumptions of force free actually break down. Your magnetic field energy density is now zero. You cannot treat that as a force free structure. What happens there is particle accelerated mostly until the equipartition. So this sigma parameter tells you that the energy density of accelerated particles which live in this, at this interface between this oppositely oriented field, this energy is comparable to the energy density of magnetic field right here or right here. So at the interface, particles are highly energetic and their energy densities is comparable to magnetic fields outwards. This is what the acceleration up to sigma parameter tells you. So these were two first-order experiments, two extremes. Say a pulsar which doesn't have pair creation at all, it formed these trapped structures, and then the limit of a force-free where particles were introduced all over the place. So what happens in the in between? And in between happens things that are actually exciting. And you can realize that by thinking that magnetosphere is actually a self-regulated system. So this pair production happens at smallest scales in the problem, like at scales of plasma skin scale. The magnetic field structure is at the large scale around this light cylinder and further out. So the two scales are separated. And in between, you actually find that this pair production provides current and charge densities, which modify the magnetospheric structure around. So there is a feedback loop over here. This region provides charge and currents for magnetospheric structure. But pair production region also depends on what happens on larger scale. So the larger scale scales tell you what the current and charges are in the discharge zone close to the star. So pair production region is also influenced by the large scale thing. So you cannot study this one not assuming anything about that and another way around. And the first experiment was also not what would you expect naively. This aligned pulsars, when you switch on the pair production, they don't develop this avalanche that I described in the beginning. So what happens here is that you still have pair production and both sign of charges on the equatorial current sheet and at the boundary of the separatrix layer. So this is electron density and this is positron density. You see both electrons and positrons at the equatorial sheet at the boundary of the separatrix, like both here and here. But at the pole, you see only electrons. So these electrons are extracted from the surface. They start to travel at non-relativistic velocities further out, don't emit any photons which are capable of producing pairs, and just freely escape. So no positrons are produced. So
What decides the sign?
What decides what?
Yeah, what breaks the symmetry? Why just electrons and not positrons? Sort of the other way around? Can you not flip a few signs here and there and get the opposite?
So what describes which sign is extracted is a relative orientation between rotational angular momentum vector and the magnetic moment vector. So if they're aligned, the orientation of the developed electric field is such that it extracts electrons. If it would be opposite, it would extract actually protons on those field lines. And protons would be even harder to pair produce because they reach even lower Lorentz factors. So even though potentially electrons could be accelerated, produce photons and pair produce, they don't. They just travel at non-relativistic velocities. So the reason for that I will describe later, but for now you need to assume that this is now well confirmed by several people, both at Columbia and another person at Berkeley. So there are several people working on that now. What would happen if you do the realistic pulsar with the pulsar with magnetic and rotational axis misaligned? Would it recover actual features that you would think are there, such as dense pair outflow and currents? So it does produce more regions where you see both electrons and positrons. So this is a 60 degrees inclined pulsar. So the magnetic axis and the rotational axis are sitting at 60 degrees with respect to each other. And part of this region around the magnetic moment is actually filled with both positrons and electrons. So you have positrons and electrons here, but only electrons here. So this is a feature which remained from the aligned rotator. Not the full polar cap is filled by both signs of charges. And part of the polar cap is still filled by both, but that's not sufficient to connect with radioactivity of pulsars. We do see pulsars mostly aligned and still emitting powerful radio waves, which are thought to be connected with dense polar outflow. So still not sufficient to describe observations. So another story is what happens with this equatorial current sheets. So in this equatorial current sheets, you develop two sort of plasma instabilities. First is the instability across the direction of the current flow, which is called a drifting instability. Basically, if you have a current layer like that, because of plasma instability, it starts to moving around. So you develop transverse perturbation and they grow exponentially. So the form is deformed across the direction of the current. And most importantly, this current sheet structure is not laminar. It's breaking into structures which you call plasmoids. So the plasmoids are over densities of plasma sitting here. I would better draw it on the blackboard. So if you have a magnetic field like that and magnetic field like that, they meet here. And this initially straight structure breaks into the plasmoids and X points. So the field line would go like that. And there is a circle of magnetic field here. So these regions we call plasmoids, and the region in between them we call X lines. So this is called X line. And then this X line, magnetic field goes through zero. So the B field is roughly zero here. And you also develop high electric fields, which are pointing out of plane, the EZ. And because the B field goes through zero and electric field is not zero, you find yourself in a situation where electric field is larger than the magnetic field. So this is interesting because in any frame, there is an invariant E squared larger than B squared, which means in a certain frame there is no magnetic field, there is just electric field. And this means the particles have to be accelerated. So the particle acceleration happens along this X lines in between the two plasmoids, and they coincide with the region where electric field is larger than the magnetic field. So this green contours are the regions where electric field exceeds magnetic field right here, and they're just between the two plasmoids in the density here. So particle acceleration happens at these X lines. This is a more zoom-in type picture into this current sheet, so you see this red square over here. The density of plasma is maximum in this plasmoids, and in between of them, you have B squared less than E squared. So this dark region corresponds to electric field exceeding magnetic field. This is a three-dimensional structure of this current sheet. Instead of a laminar thing, which I showed at the force free slide, we see all sort of plasma instabilities and of this tearing and kink mode happening all over the place. So this was hard, but this part is even more harder. You need to understand why this discharge operates differently for different inclinations of magnetic and rotational axis. And the reason for that, you can also understand using the space-time approach. If you try to calculate something like this, which is the square of the four current, the J squared minus rho squared, you can find yourself in three different situations. You can find yourself, this is zero, this is larger than zero and less than zero. So I don't know how you guys call it, but I call this situation space-like current, and this I call time-like current. So I would stick into this convention. So the space-like current appears when the J squared exceeds rho squared, and this means that you cannot conduct the current just by shooting the charge density with some velocity. If you try to calculate the ratio, the J divided by rho, which would be the mean density of the particles. In this situation where this invariant is less than zero, this would be less than one. If this is less than one, this means that you can get only electrons flying at this velocity and don't reaching significant Lorentz vectors. And this is what actually happens in the aligned rotator. If you go back into force-free solution, and that's the question, what is the J divided by the charge density times C? You will find that in many situations, you find the current which is less than the charge density times C, which means that you can create the current by just advective motion of electrons from the polar cap. And this is what actually happens in our peak simulations of all inclinations angle up to like 40 or 50 sitting around here. So, what could potentially change this picture is the following thing. So you should remind yourself that the neutron star surface, which actually provides us charges, which are later flying around in the magnetosphere, it actually lives in the region of a Kurth spacetime. And on the next slide, you can realize that the charge density that you can extract is just of order of the divergence of electric field divided by 4 pi. And this is something like rotational speed times the magnetic field. So this rotational speed is modified by the effects of GR, basically by the frame dragging effect. So the space-time rotates around and winds up the magnetic field, and you produce extra electric field because of that. And that modifies the charge density in a way that it actually decreases that. So the charge density that you would extract from the neutron star in the GR case is less than in flat space. So that your charge density that you extract is less than in flat space, whereas the current flow is set by large-scale structure. So the current flow doesn't change because your light cylinder lives in flat space-time. So in this space-time language, all these things would remain as such, but you would find that instead of time-like current, GR would make you a space-like current. So all currents that were time-like in flat space-time, they turned out to be space-like when you include GR. And this is a simulation of the GR aligned rotator. Here you would see all the evolution. So how the thing starts from vacuum, there is no charges around, just dipolar field lines and particles which start to be extracted from the neutron star. They would later produce discharges, photons, and all that stuff. So this is the complicated stuff. We'll look at it several times. There are electrons and positrons plotted here, and this positrons is a zoom end density over here. So you see how the magnetosphere forms. You see this current sheet, which is highly unstable to instabilities. It's not a laminar flow. It's a bouncing structure. But most importantly, you find that initially there was not much discharge happening over here, which means that the current at that point is time-like. But whereas the full solution is developed right now when the separatrix current sheet and the current sheet outside the light cylinder is developed, you start to see a burst of positrons produced. This corresponds to the point where the current switched from time-like to being space-like. If you look over here into the structure of how this discharge operates, you'll see, like mostly around now, that there is no laminar flow of positrons. They are produced in the discrete clouds. And the reason for that is pretty easy to understand, because when you extract one electron, it's accelerated to sufficient energies, and after that, many pairs are produced. Once you have many produced pairs, they screen the electric field, which was accelerating the initial electron in the first place. And since the electric field is reduced, the new electron, which would be extracted from the surface, cannot get to that energies. And since the electron cannot get to that energies, you don't have pairs anymore. So before this cloud is gone from the accelerating region, you don't get a second cycle. When the cloud is gone, the electric field are coming back, and next electron is picked up, accelerated, and the next cloud is produced. So the physics of pair production is really very time dependent. You get these individual clouds. And I think this is the missing link to understand the radio emission from pulsars. And the reason I think is that when I plot magnetic fields in my simulations, I see lots of waves going out from this polar cap zone. They're produced when these charges screen the initial electric field. They're tightly polarized. And when the charges are polarized, they create small but still sufficient deviations of the current density as well. So you get waves in current density and charge density in the process of screening of the electric field. So I think those waves are coherent radio waves which we see from pulsars. To prove that, I'll need to do more refined simulations of that region to calculate the spectrum. But I think the physics is there. So this coherent waves are produced by non-steady behavior of the pair production close to the polar cap of pulsar. I think I show this, and then very briefly we'll come to gamma rays. So this is a three-dimensional solution, also including GR effects. This is in the frame which co-rotates with the pulsar. So when you get an oblique situation, to find your a steady state, you need to look in the frame which co-rotates with the pulsar. In that frame, it's quasi-steady. It looks more like the oblique aligned rotator. And you again see this individual clouds escaping from the polar cap. You see the dense separatrix region where pair production happens. And you also see the fabulous physics of magnetic reconnection happening in this equatorial sheet. So initially, you saw that the two fluxes were brought together. They formed a very thin current sheet. But after that, it got unstable to plasma instability. So it's now a turbulent structure forming outside. So it's not, I like this movie. You saw a thick sheet, then it becomes thin enough. And at some point, it started to produce this plasmoids and over densities. So it became turbulent. This, I think, is not very interesting for this discussion. But I'll go directly to gamma rays. So gamma rays became a hot topic when Fermi was launched. Before Fermi, it was only around 3 pulsars known to emit gamma rays, and they were thought to be very special. After Fermi, people realized that most of young pulsars do emit gamma rays, and they usually come, the morphology that comes is you have the double peak emission. So you have a first peak, and then you have a second peak. Sometimes there is an emission between them, what is called bridge emission. Sometimes you see just two separated peaks. Sometimes the bridge emission is sufficient, so it mostly looks like a single peak.
So is it most young pulsars? Old pulsars are not
producing? Old pulsars are not producing gamma rays. So if you draw what we call a PP dot diagram, I'm not sure if here it's a good place to draw. So if you draw the period of the pulsar and P dot, so this is like how fast the pulsar is spinning, and this is how fast it's losing energy. There is a line which corresponds where the radioactivity switches off. So here you find the old pulsars which have long periods and small P dots. So nothing much happening. They are not emitting radio waves. Most known radio pulsars are sitting over here. Millisecond pulsars are a separate population sitting over here. But if you look into which pulsars emit gamma rays, you'll find an additional death line, which is sitting even further. So gamma rays are coming only from these sources. So the youngest pulsars, like CREB, which have strong magnetic field at the light cylinder, emit powerful gamma rays.
How intense is the gamma emission compared to radio?
Good question. So if you characterize this by the ratio of the gamma ray luminosity to the luminosity in the pointing flux, which is just rotational energy losses, like the total energy budget, this can reach up to 50%. For the CREB, it's like 1%, but the range of scale is that, like 1, several percent, maybe up to 50. But the radial luminosity, L radio divided by L pointing flux, is much, much less than that. It's around much, much less than L gamma divided by pointing, and it's around 10 to minus 5, even maybe 10 to minus 7 for the CREB. So most of the observed energy comes to you in gamma rays. And only a small fraction of that comes out as coherent radio emission. So this means that sufficient dissipation of this pointing flux should happen to get into gamma rays. And this dissipation of pointing flux in our simulations happens in this equatorial current sheets, as I described before. And if you try to calculate the gamma ray out of this current sheets, you see a well-developed light curve. So like this gray thing is the emissivity of all particles in all directions, and the colored thing is the emission which is pointing towards you. So you see this colored thing twice per period right now and then right here. So this is a caustic emission. This is shown here. You see many different points along the field line emitting towards you in phase. This is just the geometrical feature because this Archimedean spiral, which is a form of the field lines beyond the light cylinder, it's actually rotating and expanding. So this blue thing is is a field line. The different colored points are emitters sitting on this field line. They all keep emitting. And once this red thing emits its first photon, the first photon goes out. And at later points, it catches up with photons emitted from all other different points along the field line.
Sorry, can you go
slowly?
Okay, sure. So
what is that word? Geometry is always complicated.
So what you're assuming that you have on the field lines, you have.
Yes. So for this picture, just assume that there are emitters sitting on all these points along the field line, keep emitting. And imagine that this red thing emitted photon at the first place. Later on, when it travels, it would collect the photons emitted at different points. And they would all come towards you sitting here in phase. That's because in this picture, you saw this color thing being extended. So all photons from this extended color thing came to you in one peak. So that's the idea besides why it's a caustic emission. So photons on all this color thing comes out in phase. So why it's showing this noise is because the current sheet is highly corrugated by the plasma instabilities. These are the small scales feature on top of this light curve. Unfortunately, when people do gamma ray astrophysics, they collect a very few photons per one rotation. So for one rotation, they see one photon here, one photon here. And when they collect more pulses, they form the very smooth light curve. If they would be better, if they would see many photons per rotational period, they would see it's highly variable. That's because the current sheet is unstable and there are lots of instabilities happening around. So this is sort of the gamma ray variability that in principle could be observed from pulsars.
So you're saying, but so can I interpret this as optical depth associated with the current sheet or?
For this variability?
Yeah.
It's actually not connected to the optical depth.
So why does it turn off?
Because you don't see any photons coming towards you. They're pointing to somewhere else. So if you draw the sky map, which is the emission over the whole sky, this is the pulsar face, and this is a viewing angle at which you're looking at the pulsar. If you're an observer, you're picking just one particular viewing angle, and you're cutting it like this. If you're cutting it like this, you'll see two peaks, one from this part and one from this part. If you're cutting towards the edge of the light curve, you'll see a bridge emission between them. So either two peaks or something with bridge emission between. If you do this for highly inclined pulsar, this is 60 degrees, you only see two peaks. There is no bridge emission. So this is the light curves that you get. Sometimes they are very similar to what you observe. This is an example of the light curve which doesn't have any bridge emission, just the two separated peaks without anything in between. This is a light curve where you have asymmetric peaks like in my simulation and some stuff in between. So this connects to observations. And this is an example of the spectra of photons that you find. The colored thing are spectra emitted by two different species. The blue thing is electron emission. The red thing is a positron emission. When you sum them up, you see that mostly positrons dominate at highest end. And the spectrum is very flat before its tail and then decays exponentially. So this is what's observed also, mostly like a flat spectrum and then a turnover at few GeV energy. So the reason for that positrons are emitted at highest energies, that's because there is a preferential orientation of the electric field because it depends on the magnetic and the rotational axis relative orientation. If they're semi-aligned, then the electric field in the current sheet is pointing outwards. If it's pointing outwards, it would preferentially emit positrons. And this is what happens. So you. At highest energies, you mostly find positrons, and they emit at highest energy. So if you want to understand things like the peak energy of the emission, you can usually use the synchrotron formula because the accelerated particles, they gyrate in this current sheet, they emit synchrotron radiation. And the frequency is just the mean magnetic field that they experience times the Lorentz factor squared of the particles. And this Lorentz factor is just the sigma parameter. So all magnetic energy in this current sheet gets converted into particle energy. They accelerate it very efficiently up to sigma, and this is the frequency of the radiation. So to connect it to observed phenomenology, you need to understand what the sigma is. And for that, you need to understand what the density of the plasma is. And this is a work in preparation, but the answer is that this current sheet, they're also self-regulated. They produce pairs in this collisions of photons, and if the sigma parameter gets too large, you would emit many photons and they would not actually escape. They would be efficiently converted into pairs right in the current sheet. So this is related to the optical depths. The optical depths of the crab is a little bit before one. So they're moderately escaping, but if the optical depths would be larger, we would not see them. So they are oscillating around the state where optical depth is around one. This sets the plasma density and the sigma parameter and the cutoff of the gamma ray emission. These are my conclusions. Since I'm out of time, I would not read them or comment. So you can read and please ask your questions. This is a force on particles. I'll go to that slide. So this is electromagnetic fields. You just calculate them. You have your force, and you have an extra step in the particle pusher. You do your original Boris push. You find a new velocity. And then you can compute this radiation reaction force acting on that time step and subtract the momentum from the particle.
Yeah, so you kind
of. So this is relevant to how Zeltron is implemented.
So it's kind of like taking energy away from the particles, but.
Of the particle, yeah. You reduce the particle momentum, right?
Yeah, so shouldn't you inject this energy as electric field on the ground?
I inject it as a separate photon. So there is a separate particle species, which is called photon. It has the same energy as is subtracted from the particle. It propagates, and then I do pair production physics with those photons.
Yeah, I was asking about the light curves that you produce. So is that when you plot the light curves, is it the flux of those photons?
Mm-hmm. You just draw a sphere outwards and ask what energy and flux of photons that cross that sphere.
I see. So the light curves, in other words, do carry the information that that the plasma itself is changing
yes.
while the photon is
yes.
propagating.
Yes.
Okay, which is probably very important.
Yes.
So I have two questions. So the first one is kind of on the pushback piece side. So you mentioned in the first part that you needed in order to set up the right charge distribution, the grab GR effects were important. That's a bit, I'm very glad that were the answer, but let me see if we can push a little bit against that. So Io and Jupiter also radiate in the radio, and people have been using force gradient kind of arguments to try to argue, to describe why. And there the GR effects would be a lot weaker.
Right, the radio emission from Jupiter and Io is a little bit different from pulsar. So it thought to come from the strong current layers, something like a separatrix. And there you excite what's called kinetic Alphen waves, which is Alphen wave, which is in the regime of a collisionless plasma. It accelerates particles and you create coherent synchrotron current, or in that case it would be a cyclotron current on small scales. So it's a way different from what I described in this discharge thing.
Right, when you're trying to think of a system that would have a similar phenomenology, but where you can play around with gravity. So then, if I go back to a pulsar, so then what you're saying is if I have a pulsar dissociated to an equation state, that's
yeah.
much
luckily, softer. Luckily, it works for any reasonable M over R.
Uh-huh.
And the reason for that is that this difference between time-like and space-like current is very small. For a line rotator, this relevant J over rho is about 0.8. So you easily boost that from 0.8 to 1.4, including GR. And this is a runaway effect. If you're below one, you don't have any pair production. If you're just above one, you start to have that. So any reasonable equation of state produces space-like currents.
Yeah, again, so I'm trying to, so you have this double peak, but there are lots of people who are going after double peak, and as you know much better, there are several models out there to try to match the double peak emission from Montgomery Force pulsars, and people have accommodated that. So what would be the smoking gun at the end of the day? What is the smoking gun at the end of the day to push to say your model is better than everyone else's?
So I think this model is winning right away for the crab, because they have to explain me how you can find radio emission from something like outer gap or two-pole caustic. It doesn't have necessary physics to get radio emission.
But no, I'm going after the gamma.
Yeah, just having gamma, I think you cannot distinguish.
Okay.
So the light curve that you get is mostly geometry. To explain spectrum, they do need physics. And this they're also playing around. So like this model, say, produces from first principles. You have particles, you have acceleration produces consistently, and spectrum and light curve comes consistently. But I think the major thing that would distinguish the models is modeling the counterparts, the optical, X-ray, and most importantly, this radio emission, which seems to come, for the crab, it seems to come from the same place as gamma rays, which in our model is this equatorial current sheet. So I'm working on like understanding the X-ray and radio counterparts to the gamma rays.
And in your model, do you see an easy way to explain the shift in time that you see in the other ones?
So this, what distinguishes this pulsar and this pulsar is the magnetic field at the light cylinder. So if the magnetic field is different, I think you switch off this emission coming from the current sheet. So this emission would not come from the current sheet. It would be still your usual polar cap emission, and you'll get an offset. So in the sky maps, that's very useful when the talk is done, it went over. Oh, it's actually my computer. Interesting. Okay, so if you remember the sky map, it was like a sinusoidal curve. The polar cut would correspond to a certain angle, and you would see the radio peak, and then you would see cutting of the gamma ray peak. So this is just a separate class of pulsars with different magnetic field at the light cylinder.
So in one of your slides, you showed in your simulations the screening effect. There were these waves.
Uh-huh.
I was just wondering, just out of curiosity, are these something that could be observed? Or
which waves?
The waves due to a screening of pair production.
Yeah, I mean, as I explained, I think that those are like radio waves. But I think you're asking like the waves in the just between the clouds, right?
Yeah.
So this is related to the variability of radio emission. Since radio, I think, is produced in the individual cloud, since you don't have cloud for a certain time, this means you likely have fluctuations in radio. And this can be matched with what's called the microsecond variability of the radio emission. At microsecond scales, the radio flux is highly variable. And the microscale just corresponds to the crossing time between the two clouds. So before the next particle is accelerated to sufficient energy, something like microsecond would last. So the wave before the clouds would be the variability.
So you mentioned how sort of for computational expediency, you have to make the light cylinder sort of smaller.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that you've done some sort of systematics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in 3D you cannot do much. You do 3, you do 5, you can do 10.
Yes. So do you have an idea of like what kind of features change with that?
There is a 10% effect in the pointing flex. So the original this slide saved, I can explain. So this formula changes a little when you do larger light cylinder. So in particular, this coefficient depends on light cylinder to stellar radius. This was for, I think the ratio was 0.3 in the original paper. If you go to, I think we went to 30 in the force free, and you get 15% more pointing. So this is the largest effect in the problem for the ratio. I did not see any qualitative changes for plasma physics.
And did you try to extrapolate that to the water?
This was saturating. So there was up to 0.15, it was rising, and then we put 2 more points, it was kind of saturating. I have a paper on that, 2014, I think, with another Sasha and Jason Lee, explaining all these differences when you get to larger light cylinder. So qualitatively, nothing changes, but at quantitative level, there are 20% effects. Most importantly, would be a question about the plasma separation of scales, because the smaller scale is really the plasma scale, and this has to be really small compared to the macroscopic scales, and that we went from like 50 for the plasma scale divided by radius of the star to -1 up to several hundred. We didn't see much changes, so this conclusion about the current being space-like leading to pair production and time-like leading to no pair production was still there. And nothing qualitative changed. So.
Okay, thanks, Sasha.